from NPR Music. You're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. T-Bone Burnett is a musical wizard of sorts. He works on projects that seem impossible and makes them popular. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a good example. It's a soundtrack of American mountain music, and it sold millions. He brought fiddler and country singer Alison Krauss together with Led Zeppelin singer Robert Plant. Sure, they're talented, but there are so many ways their album could have gone wrong, and it didn't. T-Bone Burnett is a musician with a wealth of knowledge of music and recording techniques, and today he's in our New York bureau to play DJ on our show. I was trying to imagine your record collection and what the size of that thing must be.
Well, you know, I have a pretty big record collection myself, but then I also get, every day in the mail, I probably get about 10 CDs from various places that I completely don't have time to listen to. I think I got, my studio got listed in something. But myself, I don't know how many records. I still have quite a bit of vinyl and probably a few thousand CDs or something that I've kept.
Paint me a picture. Is it a big room? Is it well organized? Is it?
No, you know, the CDs are pretty well organized in a library, and the records are just sort of stacked up in the, well, I have them in shelves in my studio because I pull them out and use them, but they end up in, you know, against the wall, and I have two studios in my studio, so they move back and forth.
Do you remember starting to build that record collection, and what were the sorts of things that you started to build it with?
Well, you know, the first record collection I had was my mom and dad's record collection, and they had about three or four shelves of those old albums back in the old days. Albums used to, the 78 albums were, you know, in maybe as much as 2 inches thick with five or six different final records in them. Or in the beginning, I think they were Bakelite or something. They were some.
They were pretty heavy.
Yeah, they were very heavy. The albums were extraordinarily heavy, and they would break. But they had beautiful music. They had the Ella Fitzgerald songbook. You know, Ella Fitzgerald sings Rodgers and Hart and Cole Porter, and they had Louis Armstrong. So, you know, they had the good stuff, and I used to spend a lot of time down there listening to it.
But you were growing up, when you were a teen, what year would that have been?
1960.
Tell the truth, yeah.
1961. I would have been 13 in 61.
Now, most kids around 1961 would have run away pretty well from Ella and big band music and, you know, some of the Dorsey kind of music and things that maybe your parents might have collected. It doesn't sound like you did, though.
Well, no, I didn't. I actually got into that stuff much younger, probably when I was 3 or 4 or something. But there were all these extraordinary songs. That's the thing that struck me, you know, remember the Naughty Lady of Shady Lane?
Uh-huh. You know?
Remember Begin the Begin?
Yeah.
There were all these exotic songs that were full of place, you know. They all had a deep sense of place, a mysterious place. Hernando's Hideaway.
Mm-hmm. With all the castanets.
Yeah, all of that stuff. It fascinated me that you could evoke a place and a time and a feeling with music. I think that's the first thing that struck me. And so, I never let go of that. I've always appreciated that.
Why don't you pick us something? You're here to play DJ for us. Pick us something that maybe early on was something that grabbed you.
Well, this is a song. Here's a song from Wilbur DeParis and his Jazz All-Stars live at Symphony Hall. That's an early live recording. I don't remember. I don't have this. I don't have the album with me. Probably Tom Dowd recorded it.
He did record this.
But it's the most extraordinary live performance that I know of recorded, and it's something Stephen Bruton, whom I grew up with, Stephen Bruton's parents had a record store in Fort Worth, and Stephen's dad was a very, very good jazz drummer. And the record store was extraordinary. It was small, but every record in it had great meaning. It wasn't like the, you know, it wasn't about the top 10 or the top 20 or any of that. It was about records that Sumter Bruton thought had merit. And that was one of the very early ones. Stephen probably first played me that when I was 12 or 13 years old. So this was one of the early things that got me going toward a long life in music, and it's something I always wanted to be a part of. I wanted to be a part of an event that created this much pandemonium.
Well, let's listen a little bit. Wilbert de Paris is a trombone player, right? And he had a brother, I think, was in the band too.
That's right.
Maybe a trumpet or a cornet player. I can't remember.
I think that's right.
And let's give a listen. We'll get a sense of this. And the song we're going to hear?
Wrought Iron Rag.
Wrought Iron Rag. Great.
And that little piece only gives you a, I mean, they're just beginning to crank it up right there. It's a piece, it's about 3 or 4 minutes long, and it's just one of those pieces that's like a, you know, a supersonic jet taking off. It kind of rolls down the runway and it gets going, and then it, at some point it breaks the sound barrier, and at the end of it, the audience goes into absolute ecstasy. You can go to the website and hear the whole song, right?
You bet. We're going to put the whole song online and get the pandemonium.
Yeah, because that's when it's hard to, it's such a trip, it's such a, you know, a journey, that song. It's hard to get the full flavor of it from a minute or so.
Let's go and pick something else.
Next, I chose a song from Hank Williams. If we're going to be dealing with songs in the United States of America, we have to pay attention to Hank Williams. And this was a song that has meant a tremendous amount to me. It's not one of his very famous songs, but it's a truly great song called They'll Never Take Her Love From Me.
Great.
If today the sun should set on all my hopes and cares, there is one whose smiling face the gods would see. Cause she'll walk alone beside me up the golden stairs. Oh, they'll never, never take her love from me. What a fool I was to go and break the trust she gave, and see her love turn into sympathy. It's the one regret I'll carry with me to my grave. Oh, they'll never, never take her love from me.
T-Bone Burnett, what do you take from Hank Williams, these amazing songs from mostly from the early 50s, late 40s? What do you take from those and bring to your music these days?
Well, you know, everything, first of all. Secondly, you know, it was all recorded. It was him singing and the band playing all at once in a room where you could hear the room, you could hear the thing that was happening, you could sense the time that it was happening. And his songs, as The Naughty Lady of Shady Lane had a trick ending, you know, had a surprise ending, or is like Memphis, Tennessee had a surprise ending. They'll Never Take Her Love From Me. It has this beautiful twist at the end that wraps the song up. It's two verses and a couple of choruses, but it's like a Steinbeck story, you know. So the honesty of it, the emotion of it.
Well, we should probably play a little bit of the ending tale here.
Yeah, beautiful last chorus.
So in the song, can you quickly catch us up on what Hank's singing about?
He's saying, if the sun should someday set on all my hopes and cares, there's one whose smiling face the gods will see, because we'll walk along together up the golden stairs. They'll never take her love from me. And, you know, so he's saying there's this, you know, there's this bond between the two of them that's, you know, unbreakable. Right. But at the end, this horrible thing happens. So the second verse begins, I'm so thankful for each golden hour of happiness that we shared together in the used to be. Someone else's arms may hold her now in fond caress, but they'll never take her love from me. And then that's the denouement. I guess that's the climax of the thing, but the denouement is devastating.
All right, let's hear it.
I thought I'd make her happy if I'd step aside, but I knew her love would never set me free. And even on the morning she became another's bride, I said they'll never, never take her love from me.
God, he can write them. He lived it.
Yeah.
And you know that idea of you know, singing in the same room and creating the sound of the room, that wasn't. There wasn't intent there, right?
That's just the way they did it. That was the technology at the time. Today it's a choice we make, you know.
Let's go, and you have a record coming out somewhere, what? The
13th of May.
13th of May, called The Tooth of Crime.
That's right.
And I just want to, while that Hank Williams sound is fresh in our ears, play a cut from that CD. That's a really great song.
Thank you. You know, I think maybe that's the last song Roy Orbison wrote. I wrote that with Roy and Bob Neuwirth back in, 1990 or 88 or something like that. And when this record that's come out is for music I wrote for one of Sam Shepard's plays called Tooth of Crime. And that song, it haunted me. We had started it, and then Roy, you know, died, and there was never a place for it until this play came along, and it all sort of became part of the darkness and the story of that play and the sort of dark world the play took place in. Not the feel good record of the year or anything like that. You know.
I was thinking when I was hearing it, it had that Roy Orbison feel. I didn't have any liner notes. So, what was it about him? He had this way of being so intimate. He had what came off as a big voice. You had the privilege of working with him in his later years. What was in Roy Orbison that attracted you?
Well, you know, he did. He seemed to. He had a big voice, but he didn't do it with volume at all. When he sang, he rarely opened his mouth a half an inch. Huh. And he sang very, very quietly, but it was all tone. He did it all with tone and with the intensity of his tone. And one of the odd quirks about Orbison, because he had worked back in the old days before there were monitors, he had to learn how the notes felt in his bones, in his cheekbones and his jawbones. So when he would, in the studio, when he was using headphones, he would have the band in his headphones, but he wouldn't have his voice in the headphones, which is, you know, the only person I've run into who would do that. And he sang all of those songs, even when they would be belted out and sound completely operatic, he was still singing very, very quietly.
When I hear the music that you work on, and my favorite of the people you've worked with is Sam Phillips, when I hear that stuff, I get the sense that it's all about subtlety. No one ever screams at me.
Yeah.
The guitars never yell at me. All the corners of all the instruments are rounded off. It's not like, I mean, that's not so true of mountain music and stuff you've worked at, because you've got banjo and mandolin that have a lot of attack, but a lot of your stuff doesn't have a lot of attack. There's a lot of mallets on the drums. There seems to be a connection between all of that.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, but it may well have started with Orbison. That's when I first began learning that lesson. But one of the trends in music for the last 40 years has been to maximize attack and minimize tone. Hmm. And in the old days, engineers wanted to control things. So attack is a very simple, short event, whereas the tone that surrounds it can become very unruly. And so engineers were constantly trying to, like, for instance, tamp down drums so they wouldn't resonate.
So that's where the gate of the drum, so you get the snap of the drum and then nothing else.
Yeah, and that's in the attack is the least interesting part. But, so in a synthesizer, all you get is a pure sine wave. So the engineers for a period of time loved synthesizers because it was a sine wave that they could control with no overtones and none of those complexities, and attack. And there was also the issue of that there was surface noise on the software we were using at the time.
Right, so you had to compete with getting over that hiss.
Yeah, so that you had to get over the hiss or the crackle or whatever. They would emphasize the attack and de-emphasize the tone. But since digital came along, first of all, attack, a 10, this all gets a little technical. You can cut it out if I lose everybody. But in a peak, a 10,000 cycle peak.
Which is a pretty high pitch.
Yeah, it would be very sharp. It would look just like the end of a pencil. But overnight, it would round off. It would settle on tape or on vinyl. So that's why engineers were constantly adding high end. In digital, there isn't that mitigating factor. And the one thing digital can read really easily is attack. It doesn't read the complexities of tone and ambience and those things as easily, because it's just samples. It's pointillism. Right, just like a rotogravure or like video is pointillism. Your mind is constantly filling in the blanks. So with the advent of digital, we began working the other way. We began trying to arrange things and voice things and record things to be more in the relationship of a symphony orchestra, where the high, hard, bright things are at the back of the room, like they're at the back of a symphony, and the basses come up closer to you because they take longer. If you've ever been to a football game or a stadium in a large stadium and sat at near the top when a marching band is playing. There can be 25 tubas out there blowing their brains out, but the only thing you can hear is one guy playing a little triangle, you know, because there's nothing in the way of that high sound, and it travels very fast. So I think part of the demise of the record business has been that as things have gotten brighter and louder, they've become more and more unlistenable and more taxing to the listener. So we've, for the last 10 years in particular, but for the last 20 years, we've been exploring low-end and the complexities of low-end, the complexities of tone and overtone series and series of reflections, because that's where all the complexity in music is, and that's what makes it the most interesting to me, and that's what gives it a sense of place. I mean, a stick hitting a piece of metal is going to sound pretty much the same wherever you are, but a bass drum will sound completely different in different environments. So we've been experimenting really for 20 years to try to figure out how to make things sound good in digital. They didn't naturally.
Sam Phillips, produced by our guest, T-Bone Burnett. Take us to something something that was important to you.
Well, you know, I wanted to play Night in Tunisia by Charlie Parker, which is another one of those songs that takes you there, you know. This version of this song takes you to this exotic locale.
Andy Rosenberg is our engineer. I'm going to ask Andy just to scoot in, because we want to hear Charlie Parker a little bit, who comes in, if I remember this version, somewhere around a minute 20, minute and 30 into this amazing song. And just listen to him as looking for sax. Thank you. sense of place. It's, keeps happening, doesn't it, for you?
Well, and you know, the way those drums sound, that's the way drums are supposed to sound right there.
And vibe. I was thinking that what I hear in your music is just a feeling, and a vibe is one way to put it. I think Anushka Shankar, when we had a conversation with her and she fell in love with the music of Portishead, she said, I didn't know what was going on there, but I walked in the room and all of a sudden the room changed for me. It was the vibe.
That's right. That's right. That's what it all is. That's another way of saying we've been calling it place, but it's all vibe. It's all part of the same fabric, you know. And the freedom in there, the wildness of Charlie Parker, that's got to be one of the greatest. That riff that you started, you know, where he takes off and for his chorus is one of the most insane, you know, saxophone riffs ever. You know?
You seem to like sort of a box to put all your stuff in, or a frame to frame your songs around. There seems to be thematic ideas that you really come to life in, and be it Oh Brother, or be it the Across the Universe soundtrack, or your own stuff, there seems to be something that characterizes the whole piece.
This is the big challenge today in the new digital age, or what, you know, I'm just calling it the digital age because I'm lazy. There's got to be a better word for it, but you know, everything's come apart. Like right. In the old days, when you bought a single, you still bought two songs. You know, there was an A side and a B side. An album is a wonderful. It's a wonderful frame. You know, there's a sense of identity that you can get over a course of listening to 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or 12 songs. You could get to know an artist and what an artist is about. And at the moment, most music is being just bought and listened to, you know, song by song. So the challenge is to create a frame that creates an identity that people want to, you know, listen to a suite of songs, a group of songs by an artist. So the idea, you know, I still believe, and I'm still being able to do it, that you can create an identity out of a group of songs that will have meaning and importance to people. And you know, movies and Tooth of Crime was from a play. You know, a movie is a great way to create a frame. A play is a good way to create a frame. There you look for different methods of doing it, but you can also do it just by the very approach to recording and the approach you make toward, you know, I've just finished a B.B. King record, and the method I used for that, because the first time I heard B.B. King was maybe in 1963 at the Central Forest Ballroom in Dallas, Texas. I won't vouch for the year, but the way his band sounded in that room, reverberating through that room, the way he was, and then listening to those great Maxwell Davis records that they made back in the late 50s and early 60s gave us a frame to work within, you know, gave us an identity that we want to be true to this identity of who B.B. King was when we first loved him, you know.
So take me to something old, something maybe out of your collection that did it for you growing up.
Well, there's a, you know, Bob Dylan, of course, looms large over the whole landscape of all, you know, American songwriters. And there was a song of his that I heard at a particularly dark time of my life that I learned a tremendous amount from. And I think it's very tied to Hank Williams in a way, and it's a very personal song called To Ramona.
Ramona, come closer, shut softly your watery eyes. The pangs of your sadness will pass as your senses will rise. For the flowers of the city, though breath like it, death like some time. And there's no use in trying to deal with the dying, though I cannot explain that in lines. You crack country lips, I still wish to kiss has to be by the strength of your skin. Your magnetic movement still captures the minutes I'm in. But it grieves my heart, love, to see you trying to be a part of a world that just don't exist. It's all just a dream, babe, a vacuum, a scheme, babe, that sucks you into feeling like this.
So Bob Dylan is I mean, you've tackled who's left? I mean, you did Johnny Cash and you did the Beatles. Listen, I just read, tell me about this, that you're working on a project with The Who doing cover songs.
I was until 2 days ago, and Pete just changed his mind, apparently.
Oh.
And blogged something about how he's withdrawing from everything. But, you know, Pete changes his mind about every... about five times a day, so we'll see, is there
something in your horizon if the Who isn't the one that you want to tackle, a body of work that, you know, in some way you want to bring a shape to?
You know, I have to say, at this moment, I'm out on the road with Robert Plant and Alison Krauss, behind our record Raising Sand.
Well, what a good record that was. And that really surprised me, because I saw that Robert Plant and Alison Krauss, I thought, this could be really bad. I had no idea who was being associated with this record, but I thought, oh, this could be a bad idea. And it wasn't at all.
No. Well, you know, and the music, the band, there's an extraordinary band. Buddy Miller's playing guitar, and Stuart Duncan is playing, many instruments. And Dennis Crouch and Jay Belrose, with whom I've been working for many years, are playing bass and drums, respectively.
And what are you doing?
I'm playing guitar and band leading and singing a couple of songs and hanging out. And it's the most fun I've ever had at playing music. And really, if that's all I do the next 5 or 10 years, that's just fine with me.
That's great. Listen, thanks for doing that. I'll go out on maybe a song from that. You have a favorite on that record that you think has not been heard enough?
Oh, let's see.
I was thinking of maybe Stick With Me, Baby, but...
Okay, right on, as you like it.
Okay, great. T-Bone Burnett, thanks for doing this today.
So happy to be here.
T-Bone Burnett's new CD, a marvelous CD, we'll have some music online for you from that. It's called Tooth of Crime. For NPR Music, I'm Bob Boylan. It's All Songs Considered.
Everybody's been talking. They say our love wasn't real. That it would soon be over. It's not the